Just as technology seeks to improve upon nature, so does culture seek to improve upon human nature. The denial of Stone Age affluence is ideologically necessary, else the myth of the ascent would lose its foundation. The Hobbesian view of the state of nature, nasty, brutish, and short, motivates and justifies the entire technological program. It is implicit in the myth of progress and the ideology of ascent. That is also why many in the opposing camp who affirm Stone Age affluence see technology and culture as a long series of blunders, a fall, a descent. Another view is possible, however. Perhaps our eons-long accumulation of technology and culture has a different purpose entirely. Neither the minimization of suffering nor the completion of control that we have yet to recognize. Another reason why we assume that life in the past was a struggle for survival ruled by anxiety is that we project our own experience onto the past. As Stephen Buhner points out, any of us would certainly be quite anxious and have to struggle to survive if we were plunked down suddenly into primitive conditions. But there is a deeper aspect of projection. We believe that anxiety ruled their lives because anxiety rules our lives. We are the ones who feel that life is a struggle for survival, not they. Consider our economic paradigm. Whereas in primitive societies, cooperation was the rule, in our society, it is competition. More for you means less for me. I've got to stake out my territory and protect my interests. Even education is based on competition for grades, which are implicitly associated with eventual success in life, i.e. survival. Both our ontology and our economics set us in competition with one another and therefore generate anxiety. However, the best way to see the powerful role of anxiety in our lives is on a personal level, by examining the emotions and considerations that determine important life decisions. Every semester at Penn State, I take a poll of my students and ask them to complete the following sentence. I am at Penn State, A, to get a degree so I can get a good job, B, because my parents expect me to and I don't want to let them down, C, I don't know, college comes after high school, D, because this is where I can satisfy my thirst for knowledge. Semester after semester, a consistent 70 to 90% of the students chose A, to get a degree so I can get a good job. B and C typically draw 5 to 10% of responses, while D, because this is where I can satisfy my thirst for knowledge, averages 2 to 5%. In other words, most of the students are at Penn State because they feel they have to be there. Have to be there in order to get a degree, which means a secure job, which means money, which we need for the basic necessities of survival, food, shelter, and clothing. In other words, I tell them, you're here at Penn State, at least in large part, due to survival anxiety. Hey, it's a beautiful day. Why don't you go spend the afternoon playing frisbee? Why don't you go hang out with your friends? Why don't you play your guitar on the old main lawn? Is it because you love your classes and studies so much that you cannot tear yourself away from them? Hey, you're young. Why don't you travel the world? It is because they feel they can't afford to, that it isn't practical, that it would somehow interfere with their ability to achieve financial security. And even these are mere rationalizations for an ambient dread and guilt that informs their every moment of leisure. I give a class assignment requiring students to go home and spend 15 minutes doing absolutely nothing. One student wrote, "Pretty much the whole 15 minutes, all I could think about was what work I could have been getting done." This is a typical response. Because our culture so closely associates money with survival, the refrain, "I cannot afford to," gives us a glimpse of the survival anxiety that underlies so many of our life decisions, large and small. "I cannot afford to" is certainly not confined to contexts involving purchases. It points to the monetization of all life. As the sphere of monetized human activity grows, so also grows the pervasiveness of the anxiety arising from a scarcity and competition-inducing money system. To choose based on what we can afford is to choose from a position of lack. The mechanics of interest-based money, which I describe in Chapter 4, ensure that we never have enough. It is because anxiety is such a powerful force in our lives that we project it onto primitive life and assume that it too was driven by anxiety. We also project our own anxiety onto biology when we see it primarily as a competition driven by the imperatives of survival and reproduction. The anxiety theory is essentially a restatement of Darwinism applied to human technological development. The genes of any organism will program it to do everything it can do to negate threats to its survival. Any gene that did not do this would surely exit the gene pool. Anxiety is one of these programs. Terror is another. Technological progress, then, is viewed as an expression of the Darwinian drive to survive. As in economics, biology posits discrete individual actors, genes, behaving to maximize their self-interest, the means to survive and reproduce. Our very understanding of biology, i.e. of life, and in particular of progress in biology, i.e. of evolution, rests on a foundation of competition for survival. It is no wonder that we see human life and human progress in the same terms. The anxiety that defines so much of modern life is built into our conception of what it is to be alive and what it is to be human. The view of life as a struggle for survival is woven into our worldview on a much deeper level than Darwinism. In fact, our guiding scientific paradigms can admit no alternative. Competition is implicit in our culture's very conception of the self as an independent entity, distinct and separate from the environment and from other beings. This conception reached its fully developed form with Descartes, who identified the self as a discrete point of conscious awareness, a non-material soul separate from material reality, and with Francis Bacon, who enunciated the ideal of objectivity in science and the independence of the observer from factual reality. The foundations of science entail separation. When the definition of the self, and more generally of an organism, is exclusive and discrete, any interdependency is therefore contingent on circumstances and can in principle be eliminated. This is known as independence or security, not to depend on others. Beings are naturally set in competition with one another because more for me is less for you. The other key feature of Darwinism that conforms to our basic scientific ideology is its purposelessness or randomness, features which comprise yet another source of our anxiety. Darwinism represents a valiant attempt to reconcile life's order and spontaneity with the mechanical, deterministic laws of classical physics. In the words of one of Darwinism's most eloquent exponents, Richard Dawkins, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." This classical understanding of the universe, in which all things are composed of atoms and void, gives rise to a further level of anxiety, one that the reader may have felt upon reading the Dawkins quote above. This is, to quote Robert Lenoble, the anxiety of modern man that comes from the recognition that we too are comprised of nothing more nor less than any object in the universe, atoms and void. Perhaps underneath the arbitrarily discrete beingness we have assigned ourselves lurks a kind of existential panic, the suspicion that perhaps in some fundamental sense we do not exist at all. Herein also lies an alienation of the human spirit from the cold, deterministic, impersonal laws of physics, a sense that something essential is left out. Sigmund Freud is often quoted as saying, "The goal of psychoanalysis is to convert neurotic misery into ordinary unhappiness." Actually, he has been misquoted and taken out of context. But the very fact of the misquotation's tenacity points to the impossibility of finding real happiness within our present worldview. We can distract ourselves from the misery of purposelessness, emptiness, and meaninglessness, but they are always there, waiting for us. Anxiety and boredom flow from a common confluence of sources. Technology has separated us from each other, from nature, and from ourselves, inflicting the interior wound of separation. Secondly, the definition of the self as a discrete entity, fundamentally separate from other beings and the environment, contributes to our psychological loneliness. Thirdly, the competitive view of the world that is inseparable from the edifice of science weaves anxiety into the very fabric of life, which becomes a competition for survival. Finally, the belief that the universe at its most fundamental level consists of atomic particles interacting according to impersonal forces creates an existential insecurity, an alienation from the living and spirited world and selves we intuitively sense. To forge a new psychology and collectively a new society that is not underpinned by anxiety will therefore require a new conception of self and life, and therefore of science and the universe. Other societies, fast disappearing under the deluge of Western culture, were remarkably free from the ambient anxiety we know today. It is no coincidence that their social systems were based on cooperation, and that their self-definitions were not atomistic like ours, but relativistic, defined in relationship to a greater whole such as family, village, forest, and nature. It is a primary goal of this book to establish a different conception of life and self, founded on both scientific and psychological reasoning, from which a different sort of society might naturally grow. When our basic ontology and self-definition changes, everything else will change with it. How will this happen? What might it change into? To answer these questions, in the next chapter, I will discuss how the ascent of separation got started in the first place, tracing it back to well before the beginning of what we call technology. Knowing the state we have departed, we may better envision the state which we might attain. Understanding the dynamics of separation as an historical process, we may know better how to fulfill that process and grow into a new stage of human development. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 1, The Triumph of Technology. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren.
When I awoke to hear cry, and I dreamed I was going. And I dreamed I was going where tall trees are growing, where nine rivers flowing roll down to the sea. When I woke to hear crying, lamenting and sighing, men in yellow arriving to fell the last tree. High hills round hills of our mothers, green hills of my people that used to be free, scraped away to make room for some global growth like a tumor eats England and me. I'm a lover of England, her wild life and wisdom. I have walked the land, on those roads I have followed, through a land that's been swallowed, land tortured and hollowed for £3 a ton. And I'll hear no excuses for those whose abuses have put to such uses the land of their birth. Till there's nothing grows off it but slag heaps of for some high flyer not fit to live on this earth. Let their slaves justify it, they cannot deny it, though nightly they try it and see that our world has been wasted, skin-skewered and basted, for a dream which once tasted consumed. Are my people half dead then, from a lie that's been fed them? Those bribes which have bled them of courage and power, while our last open spaces, all those sweet, special places, are forgotten like faces that used to be ours. And I dreamed I was going where tall trees are growing, where nine rivers flowing roll down to the sea. 'Tis the Isle of the Blessed there, but there's no life oppressed there, and my land is
I'll now begin chapter 2, The Origins of Separation. Happy the age, happy the time, to which the ancients gave the name of golden, not because in that fortunate age the gold so coveted in this our iron one was gained without toil, but because they that lived in it knew not two words, mine and thine. Miguel de Cervantes, Don Quixote, Part 1, Chapter 11. The Biological Origins of Self. Technology is both a cause and a result of our separation from and objectification of nature. It distances us from nature as today's artificial environments, reliance on machinery, and processed foods exemplify. On the other hand, it is precisely our conceptual distancing from nature that encourages us to apply technology to it as an object of manipulation and control. So how did this chicken and egg scenario get started? What initiated our separation from nature, of which technology is one aspect? Jared Diamond has written compellingly of the enormous cascade of changes that followed the adoption of agriculture some 10,000 years ago. Writing, math, calendars, division of labor, wars of conquest, private property and its accumulation, money, epidemics, slavery, famines, and so on, making it, in his words, the worst mistake in the history of the human race. He is also one of the many authorities to point out that early farmers were smaller and less well nourished, suffered more serious diseases, and died on the average at a younger age than the hunter-gatherers they replaced. Nor did they enjoy easier lives. As mentioned before, hunter-gatherers also enjoy much more leisure than agriculturalists. This leads to one of the most perplexing questions in paleoanthropology. How did agriculture get started? Was it indeed a mistake, a bad choice? Or was it an unfolding of an inevitable process? And we might also ask the same question of technology in general. Was the entire ascent of humanity as a technological species predestined in the context of anthropology and even evolutionary biology? Is it built into who we are? Or is technology a mistake repeated again and again from its earliest pre-agricultural beginnings through agriculture, industry, and information technology? Agriculture was not the first technology, of course. Before then, we had tools of stone and other materials. We had fire and we had language. There is no such thing as a pre-technological human being, a pre-technological Homo sapiens. In fact, the earliest representative of the genus Homo, Homo habilis, whose fossils date back 2.4 million years, was already a fashioner of stone tools. Its successor, Homo erectus, had gained mastery over fire as well by about 1.5 million years ago. Our hands have since evolved to use tools. Our jaws have evolved to eat a diet of softer cooked foods. Our digestive systems have likewise developed the enzymes necessary to digest cooked food. Our bodies have lost most of the hair necessary for survival without clothing. Our brains have evolved to handle language. While it is certainly possible for a man or woman drop naked into the wilderness to survive, provided the right training, the way he/she does so is to begin creating tools and building a fire. As these tool-making skills must be taught, not genetically inherited, they surely fit anyone's definition of technology. Humans are by their very nature technological animals. Insofar as technology comprises learned as opposed to genetically encoded skills for manipulating the physical environment, humans are not even the only animals to use technology. Most mammals and birds learn behaviors for survival from their parents. Some even use tools. Chimpanzees not only use sticks as tools, but also select and alter them for purposes of climbing, catching ants and termites, digging roots, withdrawing honey, and as levers. The Egyptian vulture will hold a rock in its beak as a tool for breaking open ostrich eggs. A Galapagos finch uses cactus spines to pry insects from crevices. And a species of crow in New Caledonia goes a step further by actually creating tools, shaping leaves into blades. If a tool is considered an extension of the body for the purpose of manipulating the environment, then we might even have to consider as tools the calcite shells of microscopic coccolithophores made from environmental calcium. Where does the body end and the extension of the body begin? Here again we run into perhaps arbitrary or blurry distinction between self and not-self. Our customary self and not-self distinction, a characteristic of our worldview projected onto biology, breaks down under close examination. The same considerations apply to culture. Birds and mammals learn key behaviors from their mothers, if not through conscious imitation, then through play. At the very least, mothers and sometimes fathers provide triggering stimuli for neurological development. Extragenic information is transmitted, even if the ability to use this information may be genetically programmed. After all, our own genes also provide us with the physical structures to learn language. Culture, like technology, is incipient in pre-human biology. Few people would consider a coccolithophore shell to be an example of tool use, and even tool use in birds is usually dismissed as instinctive. Likewise, some authorities dismiss the tool use of wild chimpanzees, bonobos, and hooded monkeys with the claim that they don't really understand their tools, that their behavior is somehow automatic, learned through unthinking imitation. Though I really do not understand how my computer works either, I will not bother to refute this claim. The main point is that the learned use of extrasomatic objects for the purpose of manipulating or altering the environment began long before human beings walked the earth. We cannot blame technology on an unfortunate decision. What Homo sapiens have wrought is merely an acceleration of what has been going on for billions of years. Some philosophers distinguish between human and animal technology by observing that humans are the only animals to use tools to make more tools. Does this distinction represent a qualitative cognitive difference between animals and people? It seems somewhat arbitrary. However, the distinction does get at an important characteristic of technology, its cumulative nature, the fact that once started, it naturally builds upon itself, progressively distancing its users from their naked origins. Animal technology is rudimentary at best, but so is their degree of individuation from nature, their consciousness of themselves as separate beings. Consider the possibility that our individuation, our separation from nature, was not a choice or a mistake, but an inevitability set in motion before we even became human. Its culmination, then, is to take individuation to the absolute limit implicit in the Newtonian, Cartesian, Darwinian worldview. Since many animals can be considered to use and even manufacture tools, we might expect that the separation of the individual from nature implicit in technology applies to some degree to animals as well. And if animals, why not plants, fungi, bacteria, pre-cellular life, if such once existed? We commonly look upon primitive humans as being in harmony with nature, if not one with nature, all the more for non-human species. Certainly, they are closer to such a state than we, but even in the simplest of organisms, there are intimations of separation, hints of what was to come. I would like you to consider that the current age of separation started eons ago, written into the future through the very dynamics of biological evolution. It did not spring from a blunder, a distinct note of discord that one or another group of hominids introduced into nature's grand symphony. Rather, separation is an inevitable unfolding of a cosmic process. On the most basic level, by maintaining a constant internal environment removed from chemical and thermal equilibrium, all living creatures create a distinction between themselves and the outside world. All modern definitions of life draw on this concept, which is called homeostasis. Because homeostasis entails a localized arrest or reversal of entropy, it demands an energy source, for example, the sun, through which entropy is in effect exported to the outside environment. By definition, then, life creates a dualism, an inside and an outside, and what's more requires an irreversible taking from the environment. Speaking in terms of thermodynamics, life exists only at an entropic cost to the environment. Life, then, not only requires but actually is separating off a temporarily self-maintaining part of the universe. Contrary to our fundamental cultural assumptions, though, this separation is neither permanent nor absolute, but admits to degrees. Separation, in fact, inexorably builds upon itself and has done so for hundreds of millions of years on Earth, first through a biological phase and then through a technological phase. The distinction between self and environment is minimal among the earliest form of life, the bacteria, which blur the self-other distinction with their fluid sharing of genetic material. Even higher animals and plants, however, rely upon one another for the co-creation of the internal and external environments essential to their mutual existence. No plant or animal is a completely individuated, separate, distinct being. As we shall see in Chapter 6, there is no clear-cut, absolutist definition of the self or the organism. Our belief to the contrary is only a projection of our mistaken view of our own selves. Nonetheless, the evolution of life from bacteria to higher life forms did set the stage for the radical acceleration of individuation that was to follow. At this juncture, it is necessary to debunk some of the obsolete myths about bacterial reproduction. For a long time, it was assumed that because there is no shuffling of chromosomes in asexual reproduction, that evolution must happen very slowly among asexual organisms such as bacteria. As it turns out, bacteria are actually far more genetically promiscuous than any other organisms, not less, to the point where the very concept of species and individual hardly apply to them at all. Bacteria regularly exchange genetic material through a variety of means, via bacteriophages, by emitting plasmids and other DNA fragments into the environment for other bacteria to take up, and even by joining together and directly exchanging genetic material in a kind of asexual bacterial sex. The next major advance in the development of individuation came with the nucleated cell and sexual reproduction. A nucleus insulates the genetic material from the environment and allows for a more discrete, more rigidly demarcated self. Sex replaces the ubiquitous genetic promiscuity of the bacterial world with a severely circumscribed realm of genetic mixing. To the extent to which the genes define the organism, which is vastly overstated, the restriction of gene mixing to the act of sex made the organism more discrete. In light of the fluid genetic sharing of prokaryotic bacteria described above, we can see sexual reproduction not as innovation bringing organisms closer together, but as a circumscription of a prior openness, a sharper demarcation of boundaries. In other words, sexual genetic mixing channeled into a separate category and interchange that previously happened all the time. Indulge me while I speculate, half seriously, that bacterial life is one of near constant bliss, akin to a perpetual state of sexual union with the universe. When we humans engage in sexual intercourse, we recover, for a few moments, a state of being that was once the baseline of existence in a time of greater union and less separation. When we make love, we let down our boundaries on many levels, hence the appropriateness of that euphemism, love being nothing other than a release of the boundaries that separate us from another being. Bacteria maintain such boundaries far less vigilantly than nucleated organisms, and could thus be said to be that much more in love with the world. All the more blissful would be the state that admits no boundaries whatsoever, not even the homeostatic boundaries of a bacterial membrane, which goes by the name of cosmic consciousness, oneness with God, or universal love. Might we view evolution, by which the self divides from the whole and competes against other cells for survival, as a progressive distancing from that state? In this case, we can do future primitive radicals, such as John Zerzan, one better. Instead of a mere return to a pre-technological hunter-gatherer state of oneness with nature, let us undo evolution as well as technology. Let us overthrow the tyranny of the eukaryotes. It wasn't with agriculture that we went wrong, or even with representational language, but with the cell nucleus. I'm joking, of course, but also hinting again at the built-in necessity and possible cosmic purpose of the age-old scent of separation. The insulation of genetic material in the cell nucleus effectively aligned the survival interests of the organismal self with those of the DNA. Let's pretend you and I are bacteria with a common ancestry. From the perspective of the DNA, since reproduction happens only asexually to produce an exact clone, then my survival is no more important than your survival, and there is no evolutionary impediment to altruism, at least within a given species. Indeed, some have suggested that an entire bacterial species could be considered a single, widely distributed individual. The frequency of horizontal genetic transfer among bacteria further illustrates the relative unimportance of the bacteria qua individual from the perspective of genetic replication. Contrast this to sexually reproducing taxa, in which each individual is genetically unique, because you and I, no longer bacteria, have many genes which we do not share, and because we cannot transfer genetic material to each other, it behooves our genes to program us to enact behavior that maximizes our personal survival and reproduction, even at others' expense. Animals, because their reproduction is exclusively sexual, with a few exceptions, have the most to gain genetically from this type of selfishness. And the more highly differentiated from other species one is, the greater the genetic incentive for selfishness. Separation between the individual and the rest of her species, as well as the rest of nature, has an increasing genetic basis as one moves further down the line of descent. Let me hasten to add that the above analysis is somewhat misleading, based on several obsolete scientific premises that I hope to debunk in this book. The fact that competition is much less a determinant of behavior and evolution than more commonly supposed, and our view of nature as red in tooth and claw, is mostly a projection of our own cultural prejudices. We find what we look for. Secondly, the idea that genes program behavior and serve as a blueprint of physiognomy is also wrong, a product of our mechanistic worldview. Evidence is emerging that the environment triggers and even alters DNA to serve purposes that transcend the individual. Thirdly, the genetic integrity of higher organisms is not so absolute as commonly supposed. Plants, fungi, and even animals share the genetic fluidity of the bacteria in previously unsuspected ways. A fourth indication that the supposed genetic integrity of the biological self is largely cultural projection is that the leap from anuclear bacteria to eukaryotic cells, like other macroevolutionary jumps, happened through a symbiotic merger of simpler organisms. Cooperation and not competition is the primary basis of life and the primary engine of evolution. In a later chapter, I will explore how this new understanding of life may also provide a model for a new phase of human civilization. For now, suffice it to observe that the individual and modern single-celled eukaryotes and the multicellular higher plants, animals, and fungi derived from them is built upon a merger of simpler individuals. As Alfred Ziegler puts it in Archetypal Medicine, life is a chimera. DNA aside, we are all, of course, permeable to our environment as we routinely exchange materials with the world. We are semi-permanent patterns of flux with an existence independent of the specific material substances that compose us. Just as an ocean wave only temporarily comprises a certain collection of water molecules. The molecules simply bob up and down as the wave moves forward onto new ones. Similarly, even though the matter of the universe cycles through each of us at varying rates and in a unique way, we share this matter, and in our relationships co-determine each other's ever-mutating patterns of flux. Neither the matter nor its patterning constitute autonomous, independent units. The self has only a conditional reality. I will explore the details and significance of the paradigm shift in biology in Chapter 6. The key point at present is that to the extent gene-based competition does determine organisms' behavior, the separation of self from environment has an evolutionary, not merely a technological basis. Whether through proto-tools or not, living creatures, especially animals, manifest a nascent dualism through their manipulation of the environment for selfish purposes. Even if it together comprises a unified whole, life embodies at least a conditional separation, a fracturing of perspective into mine and yours. Separation began long before humans walked the earth. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Fire and Stone. Bridging the gap between the incipient separation of pre-human biology and the relatively recent invention of agriculture are earlier technologies of stone and fire, language, counting, religion, time, and representational art. By objectifying nature and humanizing the wild, by converting the world into an object of management and control, and by interposing representational systems between observer and reality, the above technologies initiated the process of separation hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of years ago. In a remarkable series of essays, John Zerzan makes a compelling argument for the pre-agricultural origins of separation. He sees the institution of linear time measurement, language, number, and art, and so on, as elements of a kind of original crime, seeds from which have sprouted forth all the noxious weeds of the ecocidal, genocidal, suicidal modern world. Addressed primarily to Marxists and anarchists who see in the overthrow of capitalism the solution to the world's problems, his books Elements of Refusal establishes that the revolution must go much deeper than that, for the root of civilization's ruin goes as deeply as all the devices which enable our conceptual separation from the world. Along with related ideas of Daniel Quinn and Derek Jensen, Zerzan's critique demands to be addressed by any serious philosopher of civilization. I will recast the phenomena Zerzan describes as a natural progression of an imperative of separation, going back even further to deep pre-human times. Separation was not a crime or a blunder, but an inevitability. The age of separation, whose apogee we are experiencing today, was, as we have seen, written into the laws of biology, even into the laws of physics, from the very beginning. Just as the widening of separation that came with agriculture grew naturally from who we were before that. Let us first ask, in what sense does the use of the first technology? The stone tools that date back over 2 million years represent a distancing from nature. Stones, after all, are natural objects, as is petroleum. What separates the tool-making Homo habilis from the non-tool-making Australopithecus that preceded him? What separates them from other animals? For that matter, what separates us from other animals? The key distinguishing factor between human and animal technology is innovation, not just tool use, but cumulative improvements in tools. And even this is a quantitative, not qualitative, distinction. Animals do learn and pass on new technologies. With humanity, the accumulation of new technologies has greatly accelerated, but it is nothing new. Whether human or animal, each new or improved tool changes that species' relationship with the environment by altering its ecological niche. For early humans, inventions like digging sticks gave access to new food sources and raised the effective carrying capacity of the land. Each improvement or invention was a step away from the natural state, quote, preceding it, and foreshadowing the present addiction to technology. Each step was irreversible once the population rose to the new carrying capacity. With the accumulation of technology, human beings became increasingly dependent on skills that had to be learned, not genetically programmed. This does not constitute a qualitative difference between humans and other mammals and birds. All rely on knowledge transmitted through extragenetic channels. Early tool-using humans merely took an earlier step of separation to a new level. Tool innovation was slow at first. Hundreds of thousands of years would pass without significant improvements. But as the culturally transmitted knowledge accumulated, its sum total came to comprise a separate human realm. The difference between an acculturated human and a feral human widened. A new stage in our conceptual distancing from nature was underway. Soon, the emergence of a separate human realm manifested in our physiology. Each technological innovation represents an alteration in the environment that exerts new selection pressures. Technological evolution thus feeds back into biological evolution. The post-tool Homo habilis was no longer the same species as before. By changing his environment, he changed himself. Hands, eyes, and postures all changed to facilitate tool use. Each great leap in proto-human evolution was precipitated or accompanied by a leap in technology. Homo erectus emerged from the very outset with marked improvements in technology over Homo habilis. Perhaps indeed such improvements were a key part of the speciation process. If so, we may view the early stages of technological development not as a series of inventions by a single species, but as a coupled biological-technological evolution of a phenotype extending farther than ever before out into the realm of inorganic matter. We would also then expect that as the pace of technological development has accelerated, that speciation would accelerate as well. We might also speculate on whether a new speciation is in the offing, or perhaps even underway. As the human realm grew and separated off from the natural, technology came to represent the manipulation and control of the world, the subordination of nature to human intentions and purposes. A self manipulates that which is outside the self. Inherent in technology is the division of the world into self and other, me and environment. Perhaps no other technology exemplifies this division better than fire, the next great step toward separation. Like other steps, mastery of fire came about gradually, not as a distinct, diluted human decision to choose technology instead of trusting in nature to provide. Homo erectus probably used it without knowing how to make it for hundreds of thousands of years. Eventually, fire came to define human beings as unique among animals. Its use in cooking changed the human digestive system forever. Its use for warmth and protection allowed the habitation of whole new ecosystems. Ultimately, of course, fire led to ceramics, metals, engines and factories, chemistry and electronics, and the whole edifice of the artificial modern world. But that is getting ahead of ourselves. From the very beginning, fire reinforced the concept of a separate human realm. The circle of the campfire divided the world into two parts, the safe domestic part and the wild. Here was the hearth, the center of the circle of domesticity. Here was warmth, keeping the cold world at a distance. Here was safety, keeping predators at bay. Here was light, defining a human realm but making the night beyond all the deeper, all the more alien. Outside the circle of the firelight was the other, the wild, the unknown. Today, as fire-based technology covers the globe and the lights of civilization penetrate into the planet's few remaining dark places, we can easily imagine that our conquest of the world is nearly complete. The domestication of all the wild, bringing the world under human control. Similarly, we imagine the light of science illuminating the few remaining mysteries of the universe, converting the unknown into the known, and subjecting the mysterious to the structures of human understanding and measurement. Consider, though, that just as a campfire deepens the shadows beyond its circle of light, perhaps our science succeeds in illuminating only that which is within its purview, which we have deluded ourselves into thinking is the whole of reality, while making the vast beyond even more impenetrable. We have convinced ourselves that the world outside the campfire circle does not even exist or is not important, or will succumb to light as we build the fire higher and higher, consuming in the process every available bit of fuel. With fire, the separate human realm began to take on a new character, linearity. Linearity is at the root of the unsustainability of the present system, which assumes an infinite reservoir of inputs and a limitless capacity for waste. Fire is a fitting metaphor for such a system, for it involves a one-way conversion of matter from one form to another, liberating energy, heat, and light in the process. Just as our economy is burning through all forms of stored cultural and natural wealth to liberate energy in the form of money, so does our industry burn up stored fossil fuels to liberate the energy that powers our technology. Both generate heat for a while, but also increased amounts of cold, dead, toxic ash and pollution. Whether the ash heap of wasted human lives or the strip mine pits and toxic waste dumps of industry. It is not that fire is unnatural. Fire, along with its biological counterpart of oxidation, is a stage of a natural cycle. Our delusional folly is to act as if that stage of the cycle could exist permanently and independently. Only someone who cannot see the whole of reality would say, "Of course, we can keep the fire burning forever. When it burns low, we'll just add more fuel." To believe that a larger and larger fire can be sustained forever is transparently absurd, ignorant, and delusional. While fuel is plentiful, perhaps the delusion might be sustained. But today it is increasingly evident that we are running out of fuel, both social capital and natural, quote, resources, even as we suffocate in the ash. The original technologies of fire mostly employed wood, thereby removing it from the normal biological cycle and preempting the natural flow of matter and energy. No longer did it nourish generations of insects, fungi, and soil. This arrogation of wood's oxidative energy to human purposes defined very early on the dominating relationship that technology embodies. Today, the same logic sees all the materials of the world as resources, classifying them according to their usefulness to man. The domination of nature that fire represents manifested in two of the earliest fire-based technologies, metalworking and ceramics. Both involve a transformation of the substances of the earth. Fire abetted the development of a separate human realm by converting the substances of nature, clay and ore, into the substances of man, ceramic and metal. Fire, the defining human technology, brings things over from the natural realm into the human. If fire consumes the basis of oxidative life, then it is no wonder that the modern technologies of fire are themselves life-consuming, both in the literal sense of ecological destruction and in the figurative sense of their depletion of cultural, social, and spiritual wealth. For modern society is based primarily on the technologies of fire. It is fire that powers our automobiles and airplanes at supra-biological speeds. It is fire that enables us to smelt metal and etch silicon. It is fire that powers our electrical grid and communication system. It is fire that allows us to distill or synthesize chemicals that do not exist in pure form in nature. It is fire that powers the quarrying of limestone and the crushing of rock to build roads and skyscrapers. Even objects as, quote, environmental as a bicycle utilize the technologies of fire. We even, unlike any other animal, apply fire to our food in the process known as cooking. Fire-based technology epitomizes the technological program of controlling and improving upon nature, usurping the oxidation of stored energy for purposes we deem superior. Not coincidentally, these purposes themselves involve the further abrogation of natural cycles. The wholesale disruption of nature and re-engineering of the physical landscape would be impossible without fire-based technology. From the building of superhighways and dams to the clear-cutting of forests, nearly all large-scale domination of nature depends on fire technologies, such as the internal combustion engine and the coal or oil-fired turbine. However, let us not forget that the initial clear-cutting of the entire Northeast was accomplished with hand axes and saws alone, also fire-based insofar as they are made of metal. I doubt a Stone Age culture could accomplish this, even if it tried. But as soon as fire-based technology gains ascendancy, such projects as clear-cutting become not just technologically feasible, but morally conceivable. As the Epic of Gilgamesh testifies, as far back in time as ancient Sumer. A reader might protest that most fire technology is based on fossil fuels, whose burning does not, strictly speak, usurp stored energy that would otherwise feed life processes, though it does diminish life in other ways. I will offer some speculations on the Gaian significance of such deep storage of energy in the last chapter. The point for now is that whether wood or oil, the mentality of burning is the same. The arrogation of stored energy to human purposes of control, accompanied by the degradation of other phases of the cycle in an unsustainable pretense of eternal linear growth. Our age is so defined by the technologies of fire that we sometimes forget the possibility of other realms of technology. Other humans in other times were actually more highly advanced than ourselves in plant-based, earth-based, body-based, and mind-based technologies. Many of the practices that we dismiss as magic or superstition actually represented modes of mind-body development whose possibility and power we do not even suspect today. Their inaccessibility is not due to historical accident, nor to willful ignorance, nor to any intentional campaign to eradicate competitors to the dominant fire-based technology, but rather to their incompatibility with our fundamental self-definition in a dualistic cosmology of self and others. Today, as our division of ourselves from the universe becomes increasingly untenable, a new understanding of self is beginning to emerge that will naturally foster these near-forgotten or yet-to-be-discovered realms of technology. We cannot understand or utilize them operating from our current dualistic ontology of the discrete, separate self. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein. Next time, we'll look at the other seminal technology that has shaped human destiny, language. If you can't bear to wait or just want more info on his ongoing work, visit ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download a copy of this program and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. The music featured in today's program was by Seize the Day, and our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you very much for listening. Come down like an